So, your questions, topics for discussion.
When do you talk crap? It's too hard.
For the record.
It's a difficult problem. and so the models are not quite as good as they could be, is what one could say officially. And of course, that's why we're here, to learn how to do things better. And I think we had a very good basis for thinking about that, at least, in all these talks. And I don't really know where to start, where we should start. I mean, perhaps we should start without rotation. Just consider non-rotating stars and see where we are there and how we can make progress. And of course, convection is a major issue there. We heard a lot about that. We haven't heard so much about convective Rosewood. And maybe I could start by asking the Ashers, first of all, whether you have any comments about the modeling of convective cores. We only heard about convective envelopes. And secondly, I'm going to include a little bit of rotation. You said that the kinetic energy flux was much higher in rapidly rotating stars.
Way around,
okay. Slow rotations have a large kinetic energy flux. I'm getting old. Would that also mean that you have stronger overshoots in slow rotators? Because presumably those two could be coupled.
So I'll answer the second one, and then I'll pass the microphone to Matt to talk about the first one. Probably yes, at least naively speaking. You get much more kinetic energy flux because the convective cells are spanning mini density scale heights, whereas in the rapid rotators, they get ripped apart by shear, and they each become a density scale height. So since you have such faster downward velocities, I would expect those would penetrate deeper or so forth.
I guess I'm talking about convective cores then. Right. Okay, so we've done a bit of calculation of you know, the same kind of simulations of core convection in A-type stars. So there are a couple of papers out there on that. I would say that, you know, our ability to say really particularly interesting things about overshoot is, at least at the time we did those calculations, was a bit limited because we couldn't model the actual stiffness of the real stratification. In the sense that, you know, that when a convective plume, of course, hits the boundary with the transition to stable stratification, it tends to drive fairly high frequency gravity waves, and we couldn't resolve those at the time, and so we softened that stratification. We allowed the breaking region to over which, you know, motions are braked to be extended. And so we were able to place sort of upper limits on the amount of penetration and overshooting. We tried to vary that in a systematic way and get trends and so forth. And I wouldn't say we found anything sort of staggering. There was a fraction of a pressure scale height in those models. But it'd be nice to revisit the problem actually now that, you know, it's been 5 years, so we could actually do a bit better job at this point. Also about the kinetic energy flux business, one thing to be, I mean, that is worth mentioning maybe for people who aren't as familiar with these simulations, is that, I mean, there, as Ben said, there's a physical effect that as you go to more rapid rotation, you can shear off some of these plumes. There is also a numerical effect too, which is that as we go to more, as we, you know, have simulations that encompass more density scale heights and are more turbulent, you can get, you know, a bigger contrast between upflow and downflow. And it's that contrast that gives you this, you know, that asymmetry is what fundamentally gives you an inward kinetic energy flux, right? So you need to be able to capture that, and our ability to capture that does depend a little bit on where, what rotation you're at and what mass you're at and all that kind of stuff. So that's one sort of caveat, I guess.
Well, of course, you're never going to be able to reproduce the realistic stiffness in the deep stellar interiors, and you always have this timescale problem that the thermal timescale is so much longer than the dynamical time scale in the core, that's, you can't really get into proper thermal equilibrium either. So one question there is whether you, by having a range of simulations, you would be able to extrapolate to real stellar conditions based on the emergent simulations. So that's the kind of thing I think we,
and that's certainly the hope.
In all of this, trying to understand the dynamical physics of stellar interiors, the only way to get intuition is to do the 3D simulations, also very similar to what Pascal was doing. But there's a huge extrapolation to get from the simulations to stellar conditions, and the question is, do we trust those extrapolations?
I would like to add a comment to that conversation. There's an irony here. If you go to more advanced stages, the thermal time scales get very short. So that in fact we can directly simulate realistic condition in the stars. However, those are not the stars we're seeing by and large.
Yes, the extent of penetration depends on the stiffness, as you say, but it depends also on the Pickley number. The Pickley number at the base of the convection zone in the sun is 10 to the 6. Those that you can achieve with numeric simulations are the order of the 100 or so. And I looked very carefully with Nick Brennan once on the results of the hash code, and convinced myself that the plumes are not going down adiabatically, but they exchange heat with the surroundings, meaning that the Pickley number was too small.
A comment on the issue about the thermal time scales in the tachocline below. Some members of the ash mob that stayed in Boulder has been working on getting around that time scale issue by looking at which way the stratification is drifting and then helping it along every now and then when it has relaxed, then move it towards what it looks like it's relaxing against and then try again. It's an iterative process, but hopefully faster than actually following the thermal time scales. But it's still work in progress.
Yeah, unsurprisingly, that's been very challenging. Yeah. Nick Featherstone has worked on that a lot. Mm. And it's been very fun. But he's working on it still.
Okay, well, I think that I would like to turn this around to there's a couple other dimensions here that I think are relevant. One of them is that from the point of view, one of the beautiful things about stellar structure and evolution is that the web of constraints and predictions you have is extremely rich, and that means that we actually now have accumulated a lot of information, you know, in terms of abundances and rotation and position on the HR diagram and other things. And so I think a synthesis of sort of what the effects that you're predicting are compared to the web of observational constraints. I mean, not one or two, but all of them in a holistic fashion would be extremely useful. That's one comment, because I think that frequently you'll find things that can solve one particular problem don't adequately deal with three or four others. The other, I think for all this numerical work, something that I find myself needing as an outsider, that's to say at least in the interiors context, we have multiple codes and we check things. Okay, and that means we have a bunch of different people who do an interiors calculation, and they all go through and they say, if I do what you do, I get the same answer. And if you don't, then you can identify the issues involved. And one of the pieces I can't get to from the outside of this numerical work is to what extent you've had multiple people trying to do the same thing. Independent codes.
So, I mean, one quick comment. So we have, I mean, very recently, actually, there's been an anelastic benchmark paper that I don't know if the paper is out yet or if it's just been submitted or if it's still in prep order. But it is, you know, basically several independent dynamo codes and doing exactly that, basically trying to do a series of test problems. And I mean, with quite good results, although they did identify some problems, actually, with including with ash. I mean, there was an issue having to do with, angular momentum conservation in certain problems. So it was a very useful exercise. I completely agree that you need multiple groups doing this. As far as what are the robust results, I mean, we can open this up to kind of general discussion, I would say from my own point of view that the thing that emerges both from our calculations at lots of different spectral types and also from other groups. I mean, you know, Patrick Coppola has seen similar things in some of his calculations in wedges and so forth. And Peter Gilman long ago saw sort of progenitors of this stuff. One you know, robust prediction has to do with the differential rotation, that there does really seem to be a difference in the sign of transport at very slow rotation and very rapid rotation, that generically if you find things that are rotating, you know, rapid-ish, you know, Rossby number is less than one, or something like one, we find sort of solar-like things, right? A fast equator, slow pole. At very slow rotation, we tend to find the opposite of that. And that is a statement that, you know, seems to hold true in all the simulations that we've done at different spectral types and so on and so forth. And then the question of how magnetic fields play into that is somewhat harder to answer. I mean, predicting the exact angular velocity contrast at a given rotation rate is a hard problem, but that trend, I think, is very robust.
Two notes on that as well. First, the benchmark paper for the different anelastic codes was actually started here at KATP during the 2008 Dynamo meeting, but it's also taken, you know, 3 or 4 years to finally get to a spot where they had robust comparisons between them. More broadly, for the global scale codes, we really need more involvement and investment. And these things are not trivial to write and to get up and running, unfortunately. So for anyone who might have influence on funding panels, you really need to start considering dedicating, you know, of order several $100,000 to $1 million per year for multiple years to build groups who can actually write these kinds of codes. I mean, you need a lot more sophistication than an individual player can bring, especially at a postdoc level or graduate student level. You need to be very good at parallel programming, you need to know detailed things about the stellar structure, and you need to have some real handle on fluid dynamics and MHD. And so you need teams for that. So for a long time, that's really limited the number of global scale codes that are around right now. I mean, there's ASH, there's Charbonneau's code, now, just in the last year or two, and then there's sort of Petri Coppola and wedges, and that's not a fair summary of all the codes out there. But on some levels, it's small number statistics like that, and each of these makes fundamentally different assumptions on things that makes it very difficult to compare in between them. There absolutely needs to be much more careful comparison between all of these different very sophisticated codes to find out what of them is real, and what are some of these subtle errors that otherwise can creep in. So, yeah, absolutely.
I'd like to just come back to something that Matt just mentioned just now, and also came up earlier today, as you mentioned that it seems to be robust that, at least it seems to be a robust result from the simulations, that rapidly rotating stars rotate like the sun, slowly rotating stars are anti-solar. Given that the sun is spinning down, how many years do we have to wait for the sun?
if you look at the spin down models, what tends to happen is the time scale for spin down gets very long when stars rotate slowly. And so you'd expect the sun to rotate at about 40 days at the end of its main sequence lifetime. The place where you might get interesting effects would be, say, if you went onto the giant branch, because then at that point you could get very long rotation periods and very, very long overturn times.
Just to make a comment, it's not going to help you specifically in this context for the solar type stars, but we do have very, very slowly rotating massive stars that are magnetic. The record is 50 years. 50 years. I know that, and to the extent, well, I don't think it adds anything relevant. It'd be actually kind of interesting to know whether the kind of thin convection zones from the iron bump might do anything comparable or something like that. I guess that's an issue for Matteo to address.
At the other extreme, there are massive stars that normally have radiative envelopes that if you
rotate them fast enough, they'll develop outer convection zones, and it's been speculated that those convection zones could then excite solar-like oscillations in stars that otherwise would not be able to generate them. Is there any evidence for that observationally?
I mean, the best place to look for that, I think, would be in BE stars, because they're likely to be very close to critical rotation. And if you believe, then, you know, depending on how the gravity darkening gets, they could actually, especially the late type BE stars, could in principle be convective in their equators.
So for the stellar modelers, what would be the best kind of star to try and get seismic data for, to test whatever is your bugaboo in your model, what thing you like to try and test the most?
All of them.
I mean, if I had my real wish list, then I know you can't do this with Kepler. I mean, but I think the fully convective stars, in some ways, are the cleanest in many of these problems, because they're, you know, they're convective all the way through. There's no subtleties having to do with Tachyon boundary layers and so forth. So, I mean, in terms of just clean predictions about differential rotation as a function of rotation rate, for instance, and magnetism as a function of rotation rate, I'd love you guys to tell us all about those stars. So, I mean, I don't know if you can get at that from spot modeling. There's some work, you know, in that direction right now. Those are the things that I am personally, you know, I would love to hear more about. But
my dream is to get the ELT when one's built in the southern hemisphere and pointed at Proxima Centauri for a couple of weeks. I don't think they're going to let us do it, but that's the nearest M dwarf, and that's presumably fully convective. At some point, if we have time, can I go back to the surface effects? But I know we talked about it yesterday, so I don't want to dominate this conversation with it too.
I actually have a new angle on it. From part of our discussion earlier, Rafa was talking about, I can't remember if this was today or yesterday, but about how magnetism could be, creates a similar kind of signal as surface effects, and that could confuse our interpretation of surface effects, right? Yeah, that was yesterday. Anyway, empirically we find that the surface effects depend on log G. That is, in every in the stars where we've tried it and it's worked well, the surface effect amplitude is larger for stars with higher gravity, that is, dwarfs. It's also true that magnetism is stronger as you go towards later spectral types. And so is it possible that that's what we're seeing, that in fact magnetic surface effects are dominating at high surface gravity?
We discussed this a bit in connection with Savita's paper, but I thought we agreed that the trend with log G was artificial, in the sense that the surface effect in microhertz for a given star as a fraction of its large frequency separation, so in other words the correction over delta nu, is pretty well constant. And that's essentially the same as saying that the epsilon offset is pretty well constant. And that's indeed seen by the figures that you showed, Travis, where all of the stars lie kind of above all of the calculated epsilons by about the same amount. So I guess, I don't know how Savita's paper ended up in the final version, but at one point we were discussing that correlation wasn't real, or was at least wasn't what we thought it was.
The way it ended up is that we have multiple ideas and we don't have a clear idea of which one's the best, and so we just didn't mention it.
Oh, maybe we should at some point, those of us involved in that should sit down and have coffee and talk about it while we're here this week. Yeah, cool, is not it?
Well, you have to support him entirely in the sense that I think physically what the surface effect could be sort of is the phase shifts, an error in the phase shifts that the waves go through as they are reflected from the surface. And the phase shift is exactly what's determined by, or epsilon is exactly determined by a combination of the phase shifts at the upper turning point and the lower turning point. And the phase shift at lower turning point, we sort of believe that we have a pretty good handle on. So what we call the surface effect is really an error in the phase at the reflection at the other turning point. And that could have contributions from all the things we've been talking about, I mean, both the errors in the structure and the turbulent pressure and the non-adiabatic effects and so on, could actually all be included in this kind of a phase shift. The phase shift would become complex. I can see Douglas is looking worried. But
yeah, and can I? While I still have the mic, can I ask Jörn a question then? You said that it's the upper turning point that's crucial. Is it just the physical location of that?
No.
Which it's what happens at that upper turning point. Because Sabani suggested yesterday, I think very well, that we should be comparing the different solar models, Model S, with the various other models and see what they all do at the upper turning point.
Oh, sure.
I think that's what you suggested.
But we've done that 20 years ago for the sun, and we know that.
Yes.
If you change, we both have a microphone, that if you, for instance, change the details of the convection treatments, and you have to calibrate the mixing links to get the ratios right, but change some of the other parameters in the mixing link formulation, then you get a surface like, an effect like the surface effect. If you change the atmospheric opacity, you get the same. So all these things are in play when we compare different solar models, and for that reason we get different surface effects comparing different solar models with the observations. So there's no surprise in that. But this is just a structural effect, and then there's also all the dynamical effects, like the turbulent pressure, and dynamical effects of turbulent pressure, and non-adiabatic effects, and magnetic fields that we also ignore.
What I was going to say is that, yes, we've done it for the solar models, but the people in the stellar community don't seem to know that we've done it, and they're repeating the same mistakes that we made 20 years ago. And I just want to remind Jan that there have been tests for the SCORE meeting, if you remember, 1996, where people did try to include turbulent pressure, etc., in models. And again, it was a surface-like term, same thing. So which is why whenever people say they've solved the surface term problem, I'm completely skeptical. I mean, it's a problem with it, that things happening at the upper boundary, and anything that affects the upper boundary will give us a surface term.
Did anybody ever say that solved the problem?
I would also like to caution that the results from the Kepler sample could be misinterpreted as a shift in epsilon for the following reason. Because we're only observing a narrow frequency range that may not go down to the low frequencies where the surface effect really is negligible, because when we're fitting the surface effect, we assume that the lowest observed frequency tends to zero, we will in effect create a shift in epsilon potentially.
Yeah, I see your point, but when you fit the surface term, you're assuming that the discrepancy gets smaller as you go to zero, but you're not assuming that it is zero at your lowest observed frequency. You're just assuming that you're on the way down. And so if you're adopting the Kelson method of fitting the surface term, then I don't see a problem with that. It would be nice to have lower frequencies. The more at the low frequency, the better. But it doesn't invalidate the method, and I don't think it introduces a bias in that way.
Just as an answer to that, as a practical matter, when we're interpolating the age of the model, what we do is ask that the lowest frequency, the difference between the lowest observed and model frequency, be zero.
Oh, I disagree with that.
Yeah, it's going to be close to zero in real life. But you're right, it does create a slight bias. That's my caution.
Yes, I am a little more optimistic than you are, because you have worked between 96 and now, and you have observed how the magnetic field evolved along the solar cycle. And this is something that we have never used up to now. And if we all more or less agree on turbulent term, we have not yet introduced the magnetic effect that you measured by SOHO MDI at the bottom of the surface layers. And we need to play with that to already say something about the sun, and probably, maybe after extend to some other case for star where we cannot know properly the magnetic field, but we can see the effect of the magnetic field.
We're talking about two slightly different things, because in the solar case, we are comparing solar frequency with solar frequency. So the magnetic field effect is solar frequency at one epoch with the solar frequency at another epoch. If we just took a solar model and compared with solar frequencies of two different epochs, the surface term is so big that we won't see too much of a difference between the two epochs. So the in terms of models, the effect is much, much bigger. So yes, I mean, the magnetic field does give a surface light term, except that there are subtle, deeper signatures hidden in that, but the magnitudes are quite different.
Yes, but what I think about is to compare with the global modes, the radial modes, the dipole modes, where we see really the amplitude of the variability with the solar cycle.
I'm just sort of questioning whether this approach is fruitful in the following sense. Okay, we didn't try to understand stellar evolution by trying to understand every single possible way we could mess up the radius of a star. Right. What we did is we said we have things that we calibrate, we have places where we kind of know the answer, and we understand and correct for these terms. If you had physics where you actually really needed to know what was happening in the very, very near surface layers, you would have to do this, but I don't know that I would trust the results that came out of that. And so what I would operationally think that would be most pressing would be to identify places where you knew the answer from some independent means, and you could then calibrate out the functional dependence of these terms. So, and if you had places where you could do that, then you would have a way at least of differentially identifying patterns, right? And the solar calibration is one attempt to do that. And so I'd want to find stars where you had a dynamical mass and you had good composition and you had good information on what it was. And I think that that would be a good way of removing this difficulty in interpreting the frequencies. Am I off base on this? Or because if you really want to dig into the physics, you're going to go down a rabbit hole and you're never going to come out.
Well, on that issue, I think, well, you talked about turbulent pressure being solved, that we know how to include it in 1D models.
In fact, it's more discussed than the magnetic effect on the turbulent.
Yeah, okay. Anyway, so we're not quite sure how to include turbulent pressure in models, so we're not quite, so I agree with you. We should just use a functional form and calibrate it out in the reduction of the, like it's done in the AMP package. But with the caveat that maybe the shape is not universal. It seems from looking at the BL-RDF stars that maybe it's not the same for F stars as for solar type stars. But that could be checked by making a perturbation between and compare two models and find out what the shape for an F star would be. And then you could hopefully calibrate it up.
We shouldn't be stuck on the surface effects all day, because there are a few other problems. But just to get back to Mark, the sun is the only case where we can actually really calibrate the surface effect out. And the reason we can do that is that we have got modes of high degree, a range of degrees. And that's what allows us to separate the effect of the uncertainty in the interior from the surface effect, and then we know the functional form in the sun. What we can do for other stars, if we have these observations you talk about, would be sort of get an average surface effect, but that's not nearly good enough, because what we want to use the individual frequencies for doing the astroseismic analysis, and so we need to know the surface effect as a function of frequency. And the best we can do so far because our physical understanding is so poor, is to use the solar calibration that we have and then have an amplitude factor, but assume the same kind of same function form. And that's what we're doing in the Kelsen procedure. Now, we have to combine that. We're trying to get a better and better physical understanding of what's going on, and then possibly, based on that, know how to change that function form for other stars, including the body of stars.
Just one comment to what Jorgen has said. You have now a second star, which is HD4993, in which you have the functional form of the frequency shifts in minimum and maximum. So you can play with the HD4993, which is, I want to say, it's going to be observed again with Korov from January, at the same time with Narval, and also with the Kelsen HK survey.
Yeah, and I just had a quick question for the helioseismologists. You see differences, you see frequency shifts as a function of phase in the solar cycle. Can you see a difference in the surface term correction as a function of solar cycle?
And those shifts are different for modes of different degree, so we can make some deduction, inference, about the latitudinal distribution of what's happening, and there is some correlation with the latitudes of magnetic activity. The results are not extremely good, but you certainly see that, and it's certainly going on. And this is actually a worry related to what Jan was saying, because he said, we think we understand what's going on at the bottom. And one of the reasons is because we're taking out the degree dependence. But that statement is perfectly correct if the star was spherically symmetrical, but it isn't. And I think I have heard today, if I remember correctly, that some stars are not spherically symmetrical. And so that's a very big worry.
We have maybe another issue we want to raise. Move on to the next topic.
This kind of goes to Jennifer's point, but it's actually an interesting question for people who are looking at the pulsations. If you think about how we made progress in stellar modeling, we tended to pick systems like clusters, where you could look at an ensemble of stars that were basically different masses but the same composition and age. And another interesting way of testing stellar interiors theory is constructing sequences where the mass is being sampled at different evolutionary states, right? And so one I think really nice project in the Kepler domain that seems to me to be quite feasible would be to see if you could pick out samples like that for detailed studies, right? And this would involve possibly spectroscopy or the like, but is there, so for example, pick out a sequence of one solar mass stars that you follow up with a subgiant branch or something like that.
Victor, do you want to talk about that?
Yeah. And but to follow up detailed studies, so basically those are your shortcomings targets.
Victor's going to tell us about this tomorrow, actually.
So, I mean, yeah, but that's the idea. That's precisely what we're trying to do. And what I'll tell a bit about tomorrow is that, okay, we can build the sequence. The idea will be to follow the evolutionary changes with individual frequency determination then for the sequence. And we're not going to have for all of them, of course, but at least hopefully we can put some anchor points and see exactly what's going on in the inside. And also, I'll discuss a bit a way that maybe we can get rid of the surface effect. I don't know if that's true or not, but I think our models are not doing very well in that sense. Yeah.
I'll just pitch in here that I think hybrid pulsators that show solar-like oscillations in addition to some sort of classical pulsations are Rosetta Stones, because traditionally the problem with some of the classical pulsating stars has been mode identification, which is not a problem for solar-like oscillations. And so if you have solar-like oscillations and can model those, it puts very strong constraints on the model that must also create those classical pulsations. So that's my wish list, is for stars that show multiple types of pulsation at the same time, in particular solar-like and something else.
Could you please explain to me, why with solar-like oscillations the identification of modes is not a problem?
The question is, why is mode identification not a problem for solar-like oscillations? And the reason is because nearly the full spectrum of oscillation modes is excited, the full sequence of radial overtones. And there are well-established relations, simple scaling relations, that can tell you the L and the N value of those modes. And I believe in the tooth fairy, too.
Yeah, but I might wait till Friday.
Yeah, I might just add, in the case of rapidly rotating stars, if you had a hybrid pulsator, if you had high-frequency solar-like modes, they would tend to be closer to the asymptotic formula for frequencies, even for a rapid rotator, just because they're higher frequency and the avoided crossings are less important.
Vicky? Thank you. So I guess actually we already have one such star, so I hope I will talk about that again on Thursday. So it's a Delta Scuti star showing also solar-like oscillations. And on top of that, it's also a chemically peculiar star, an AM star. So it's the perfect laboratory to study several types of physical processes. So that's why and I know it's very complicated, because we have to deal with convection and with Kappa mechanism. And I think they sort of interact. But I hope that modelers would really start to work on the star. So.
I just want to change the subject completely and get away from these wretched solar-like stars. So what are we going to learn from STB stars, compact stars, whether or not they are wrapped in a big red giant? I mean, the envelope, of course, is irrelevant, really. So what kind of stellar physics are we after when we study STB stars? I mean, Hailey, are you here somewhere?
Well, we can learn a lot of physics. Like I mentioned yesterday, we can learn what process should slow down diffusion, because diffusion is actually something that's present, and you need another physical process to slow it down. And I've been thinking about this today and talking to some people. Maybe we can learn something about convective overshoot on the surface convection zones. So that's not, these are the very thin convection zones. And in the 1D models, we don't really include overshoot there, because the overshoot that we have is calibrated on the overshoot on the core, but I'm sure it's definitely different for the surface convective zones. So that's something that we might learn about.
Yeah, go ahead.
Maybe something about differential rotation. I don't know if somebody else wants to say something about that.
And what about the convective core? Because these stars are helium burning, so they surely have convective cores, and we should be able to learn about the properties of convective cores. And I should remember that, Valerie, if you're there somewhere, in your fit to the STB data, you found a much bigger mixed core than the actual convectively unstable region. So, suggesting that there's quite a lot of convective, of extra mixing at least in these stars.
Yes, in the three long period SDB star we modeled, we find that the chemical transition between the mixed core and the helium mantle is well above the convective core itself. And so it means that there was transport of carbon and oxygen up the convective core. And if we look at the temperature gradients, we think it's the semi-convection effect. But we still have to investigate that thing.
Yeah, because these stars tend to have growing convective cores as they evolve, so you also build up, you have the potential of building up a density discontinuity at the edge of the core, which is more or less what you show, Hylene, in your buoyancy frequency plots. You get these sharp features, and you ought to be able to see diagnostics based on that.
Well, the problem is that now the observations seem to claim that there's no significant mode trapping, while the models all show significant mode trapping. So that's still something that needs to be solved, whether the models are wrong or the observations are wrong. But I just want to say that if we know that period spaces are constant, that will definitely give us constraint on the mixing processes at the core. So in that sense, that's a powerful diagnostic, because the current models show that there must be a chemical gradient, and it's steep and gives mode trapping, and if that's not observed, there must be a semi-convection or whatever operating.
Yes, concerning the mode trapping that is supposedly not present in the observation. Well, the observations are not wrong; they cannot be. But the interpretation that we make of them might be wrong, though. So, in the case of what Mike claimed, in fact, that he was only seeing flat period spacings, which with no perturbation of it, which would be the indication that there is no trapping. I think you have to be cautious about that, because it's based only on a subsample of the modes that are observed, and the way he derived this, he might actually reject all the modes that do not fit this relation. So the interpretation or the identification that he makes of the period that we are seeing might not be complete. So in that sense, if you filter out all the modes that do not fit asymptotic relation, then you're bound to find to conclude that there is no trapping, but that's maybe not the case. Okay, that's one point. Yeah, so an open question then, if you want. Concerning what we can learn about SDB stars, so you mentioned the rotations. It's probably a very interesting aspect, because since these stars are quite evolved objects, the way they rotate might give us some information on the evolution of the angular momentum in stars in general, on the the history of the angular momentum. So that might be interesting. So it's a bit early to say. Well, I don't want to do my talk now, in fact, because this is something that, I mean, those aspects we will talk about that on Thursday. So maybe we should not develop too much.
Okay. Yeah, just to say there is something in common between SDB stars and the special mean sequence star that Vicky was speaking about. And what's in common is that you need to have chemical segregation to have an accumulation of iron or nickel or something somewhere to be able to explain the observations. So I think one issue is related, of course, it's something I spoke of, but related to a better understanding of chemical separation, chemical diffusion, and the hydrodynamical processes which are related, which must work in both kinds of stars, and explain the observations in both kinds of stars.
I'm a very shallow guy, so I'd like to come back to your question about the surface convection zone. Well, I haven't tried to make a simulation of that particular star, but my experience with very thin and inefficient convection zones is that you get much larger velocities, actually. And I would expect a lot of overshoot, and I would expect a lot of mixing in a large area around the convection zone. And sometimes in these hotter stars, 1D MLT models would predict several thin, two, maybe three thin convection zones just below each other, and I have seen such two zones at least merge. So, Hydrogen and iron, I believe. I don't know. No, that can be helium. Yeah.
I just want to say that would be lovely because we need mixing beyond the Irwin convection zone to explain the observations, and we don't have that in our model. So if there's some kind of calibration that you can give on the diffusion coefficient of the overshoot or the extent of the overshoot, that would be very nice for the 1D modelers.
And now for something completely different, involving SDB stars. We see a number of the pulsators that are in close binary systems with periods of order a little bit less than half a day. And one might hope then to see if the SDB star is rotating synchronously with the orbital frequency, since you can measure rotational splitting. And what we found is from Kepler data for three of these targets, none of them are rotating synchronously. They're all rotating a factor of 20 or so slower. So it looks like the synchronization timescale for these systems with these particular parameters are longer than the lifetime of the objects. In all three cases, we're pretty sure the secondary is a low mass M dwarf, probably. So it's a low mass ratio, and we may be able to probe the mass ratio dependence of the synchronization time, because there are other STBs with similar periods that do appear to rotate synchronously, phase 48 being an example. So we may be actually able to map parameter space for tidal synchronization in closed binaries using the pulsating SDB stars.
So I wanted to sort of change the subject a little bit and ask, I think this community should think about what you can tell the allied people in stellar physics outside of this community. So for massive stars, of course, there's lots of questions about evolution of rotation, and that's been touched upon today, except unfortunately there's not a lot of pulsators up in that mass range, and so maybe that information isn't so relevant. But if you look back on the history for the solar case, of course, I don't have to tell you, but it's important to remember that the probes of rotation, which led to really a deeper understanding of the magnetic field evolution of the sun, came from this community. And I think that sort of impact outside of yourselves is an important thing to think about in terms of how you focus your efforts. So I'm speaking somewhat as an outsider, because I think it's fantastic what's happening with Kepler, but if you ask yourself 10 years from now, you don't want to be talking about surface effects. That's not going to get the sort of resources that the community probably would like to see coming to it observationally or even for theoretical support. And so I think it is an important question to ask. What probes can what can you say to people who are studying other issues, let's say just within stellar physics, those who do population studies in galaxies, those who study supernovae, those who worry about, compact remnants? That's one community, and winds and mass loss, where I think this community can say a lot. And I think the work we've already seen on open clusters for 6791, where basically there's not evidence for mass loss on the red giant branch, is in complete conflict with, about 10 papers saying that that was the only way to explain the white dwarfs. That's very interesting, and that's the sort of thing where I think this community can really have a big impact outside of itself, and I'd sort of encourage that discussion a little bit, even though we only have 7 minutes.
Yeah, I agree. I agree with Lars completely. And until you said it, I was going to say mass loss is a huge thing for the stellar community. And the other one, which Travis whispered to me, and I was also about to say, is ages. Everyone wants to know ages. And so we need to get our act together and deliver ages that we think are accurate and precise, and try to understand why there are so many differences in the various methods of determining ages. So modelers, why are there so many differences?
No, for once it's actually the core effect. I mean, you're quite right, Lars, of course, we should think about that. But both in terms of the age determination, for many stars at least, and in terms of preparing stars to explode as supernovae, things like the details of what goes on in the core is really crucially important. Because if you want to get an age, you need to... You get the age from the structure of the core somehow, and how much hydrogen has been burned. And that depends on how much convective overshoot, how much semi-convection, how much rotational mixing, how much garbage is going on in the core of the star. So to give reliable ages, we need to understand these physical processes. So that's one reason why we need to do that. And the same, of course, with supernovae. I mean, how a star evolves towards becoming a supernova depends a lot on the kind of mixing processes that go on in the very early stages of evolution, including the hydrogen core burning. And we are lucky there that we do have the Beta Cephei stars, which can be wonderfully interesting stars, where we have a chance of doing astroseismology to study these detailed physical properties in the course of massive stars. So we have to make clear to the outside community that they can't really use the stellar evolution models before we understand all these aspects of the physics of stellar interiors. And that might be a hard sell because you guys don't understand much about stellar evolution, but we should try.
So something else that I think the stellar populations people would really like to know is the helium abundance, or at least an idea if the helium abundance is varying differently than we expect, because right now people are appealing to helium abundance to explain all sorts of things, like the stellar populations of globular clusters, maybe the lack of a red giant bump in the galactic bulge, and so we cannot spectroscopically for many, many, many stars measure the helium abundance. It's the second most common element. We feel really stupid, so we could really use some help.
There's also an obvious connection between astroseismology and exoplanet science, and ages are important there for determining the chronology of star formation and planet formation. But in addition to that, the inferences that we can make about the interior bulk composition will have an impact on that community in the sense of migration of giant exoplanets, for example, and pollution on the exterior layers or not.
Well, just to get, of course I agree, but just to get back to the helium abundance issue, and Werner Deppen talked about that yesterday, that's we do have diagnostics coming from the second helium ionization and its effects on the frequencies, which we now see in red giants. We see that signature. And so we have a chance of determining the helium abundance in red giants if we understand the equation of states. So again, we have this coupling to physics. But of course, we need to work on that, and there certainly is a potential to determine helium abundances in red giants or possibly also in main sequence stars from that kind of diagnostics.
Just to react on what you just said, if you have giant planets or anything heavy material accreted on star, it doesn't stay in the convection zone. It falls down because of thermohaline convection. And I think that's really a robust result. We have a paper which is going in APG, which is accepted, I mean, but also some other people, like Pascal, also looked at that. So pollution is not expected. I mean, not staying and not changing the abundances in the outer layers.
So you would not be able to tell seismically the difference between an externally polluted star?
That's something we wanted to do in the past. Now I don't think we are able to do that.
Good to know.
Just to briefly come back to the helium abundance, I don't know why Andrea is quiet, but he does have a program to look at helium in red giants. Okay, that explains why his name is in bold there. And Anvesh Mazumdar couldn't be here for family reasons. He is looking into some of the solar type stars in WG1 to look at the signature, except that the frequency errors are still a bit too large. I think we need better frequencies before we can do that. But yeah, at least for a handful of stars, we'll definitely have helium abundances.
So Mark and I have had this conversation, and Mark points out that for the globular cluster giants, these are like tip of the red giant branches where we actually have abundances in CNN. So we know which ones are supposedly helium rich and which ones are supposedly not so helium rich. We don't need to know exactly what the helium abundance is. We just need to know that there's some signature that's different between the two of them, which implies that there's a compositional difference. Or we'll take an age difference, just something.
It's 2/10 of a solar mass.
So, and they're all the same, just, I mean, they're just...
The same luminosity.
Yeah, same luminosity, right. And, you know, we can tell you which ones we think are going to have, you know, we can put them in two groups for you. So this one, we're just, you know, either they'll be rejoicing in Padua or there'll be tears in Padua when this is done. But, yeah.
But you were talking about globular clusters, right? Right, so there are none in the field of Kepler, but there are open clusters in the field of Kepler. Are they any use to you? And while I've got the mic, Sabani, will we be able to measure oscillations down to the main sequence with an extended mission?
6819, we might be able to get turn off stars and a bit down the main sequence, except the main sequence, the turn-off masses are probably too high for 6819 to actually see oscillations. 6791, no, we don't have any hope. It's too crowded, and the main sequence, even the subgiant branch, is very faint, so no. So, and if we could get better classical data, membership, etc., in 6811, we might be able to do that, because that is a very bright cluster. But we know almost nothing about membership of 6811, so we're not even trying anything except some of the red giants. Yeah.
So if 6791 has the CN anomalies, which is, I think, either unclear or doesn't, okay, then that would be a similar kind of thing. But I'm happy to talk to anybody about this, because I do not know the answer. But we're hoping that we can, for the bright globular cluster giants, maybe do it from the ground, because over an extended period of time, I mean, Ogle could find oscillations. So I'm hoping that if you're going to go for the tip of the giant branch, maybe we can do it from the ground in some nearby globular clusters. But if you want to douse my excitement or make me even more excited, please talk to me.
Okay, just to propel us into happy hour, unless anyone has an objection, I'll just throw out a really crazy idea. There's often been an analogy between seismic waves and optics, and earlier this year it was discovered that the laws of optics that we all learned in school, reflection, refraction, are approximations to reality. And in fact, if the surface has a nanostructure on it or is patterned in some way, those laws can be modified. And so it strikes me that the base of a convection zone, for example, might not be a perfectly reflective surface. So with that, let's break for wine.